At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. One of the internet's favorite fights is over the right way to use language. If you get into an argument and forget to pick the correct spelling of there, or there, you automatically lose whatever fight you're in because you are clearly the dullest crayon in the box. It's an easy and lazy way to claim superiority over a stranger. It's also a marker that you're clinging to what is known as prescriptivism, or enforcing made-up rules in order to appear smarter. Tell that to 10th grade me. If you do that for long enough, chances are that you might get a response from my guest today. Danny Heber earned his Master's of Arts and PhD in Linguistics from the University of California, Santa Barbara, and his Bachelor's degree in Linguistics and Philosophy from the College of William and Mary in Virginia. Prior to and during graduate school, he worked for Rosetta Stone's Endangered Language Program to create language learning software with Native American communities. I sat down with him to ask, what even is language? Why are there so many rules? And do any of them even matter? Here's Danny Heber. Danny Heber, welcome to Head on Fire. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I have been a fan of yours for quite a while, pretty much since I got on TikTok. Your videos have been like force fed to me because whatever algorithm runs the internet knows that I like what you do. But for people who are not me and have not been force fed your content like a goose, tell people who you are and what it is that you do.
My name is Danny Heber. I am a linguist, is the easiest way to describe what I do. But more specifically, these days I work with Native American tribes whose languages are endangered. The languages are not being learned by the children anymore or just by very few kids. And so they're having difficulty passing these languages on. And so I work with those communities to help document those languages. A lot of times these languages like haven't been written down or they haven't had like a grammar textbook or dictionary written. So we help document that and then figure out how the grammar works and write grammar textbooks and dictionaries about it. And so I work primarily with one tribe in Louisiana called Chitimacha. They're a small tribe. I think there's only about like 2,500 registered tribal members. But they're a federally recognized tribe. They're, you know, completely legit. It's just no one's really heard of them usually. And I've been working with them since 2008 when I used to work at the Rosetta Stone software company, the language learning company. And we made a Rosetta Stone software together. And then afterwards, the cultural director asked me, would you continue to work with us? I said, yeah, absolutely. So that's the primary thing I do. And then the other thing I do kind of on the side is, as you've seen, linguistic discovery videos. So that's my social media channel. And I love educating people about the diversity of language.
How do you go into a language that you don't know, that very few people know, that is, in your words, dying, and learn it? Learn it so well that you can now teach it back to them.
This is such a great first question. I'm so glad you asked that, rather than how many languages do you speak? It is so much fun. It is a lot of puzzle solving. So imagine that, do you speak another language, Spanish, French, anything like that?
My mother-in-law is very kind about the amount of Spanish that I speak.
Gotcha. So imagine there weren't a Spanish textbook. And like in existence, period. And you had to go about learning Spanish and practicing with your mother-in-law, say. And so what you might do, aside from just kind of like sheer immersion, if you really wanted to go about it in like a methodical way, that you would find patterns. So you would say, how do you say, I am eating? And you say, estoy comiendo. And then you would say, how do you say, I will eat? And you say, voy a comer. And then you would repeat that with a bunch of other verbs like run and dance and sing, etc. And eventually you would start recognizing on a pattern and like, oh, every time I say present tense, like I am whatevering, then I see this yendo or ando ending. And so that must like correlate. And of course, you'll discover that English ing ending correlates to or corresponds to multiple things in Spanish, and certain things in Spanish correspond to multiple things in English. So there's not like a one-to-one mapping. I mean, this is just basic translation studies and translation issues. Like you never have a one-to-one mapping between words and grammatical concepts in one language and in another language. So a lot of times those translations will eventually start to lead you astray, and you have to focus more on like the conceptual. You have to focus on, okay, this is a grammatical future tense I'm looking at, whereas this is like a gerund, and focus more on its function rather than just like kind of the direct translation. And you do that enough and you start discovering all sorts of cool things. But it's very tricky because some stuff, a lot of things are optional in language. Mm-hmm. So Chitimacha, for example, has a topic marker, and you put it on usually one thing per clause, and it's a little suffix, a sh suffix, and you put on the clause whatever word it is that you're talking about in the clause. And that might be different from like the subject or the object. We do this in English too. We can say like, it was the girl who saw the dog. And then I'm really emphasizing the girl, even girl's kind of like acting as a subject there, but you could say it was the dog that the girl saw. And so in English, we can't directly do it. We have to put like a relative clause in there and this convoluted word order thing. But in Chitimacha, you don't have to change anything about it. You just move the topic marker from the subject to the object, and that'll indicate it for you. But that's really tricky. That's this like high level discourse stuff that you have to be like aware of what you know about the situation and what the other speaker knows about the situation, what you think they know about the situation, and kind of like constantly be negotiating that. And so that kind of stuff gets much harder to just get by like direct translation. You can't just like pair up sentences and translate that. You have to go look at a corpus, a collection of sentences or texts in a language, and just start seeing like, okay, and this is what I had to do. This is one of my grad school papers is doing this, was, okay, every time this suffix appears, what the heck is it doing? Like, what, it seems random, you know? And then eventually I figured it out. It was like every time they changed topics, this thing would come up.
That is so fascinating to me. And I have a question now. What's the next step for this collection of knowledge that you're creating? So I say this maybe, and maybe I'm saying it wrong. Maybe this is a slightly insensitive thing to say, and I apologize in advance, but if a language is dying because people don't want to learn it, what do you then do with the preserved language? Just store it somewhere in hopes that someone someday cares? Or
right.
What's the hope that we're doing with this collected knowledge?
This is such a great question. It really goes multiple ways. So the first thing I like to try and emphasize is to not fall prey to this idea that there's some sort of like objectively valuable thing about language or languages.
Sure,
like languages are valued because people value them. And yeah, if there is nobody that wants to speak a language, like in some communities historically, people have associated their language as a thing that makes them a target of oppression. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so they want to distance themselves from that.
To put that in just other context that maybe people might be more familiar with, there's a lot of Spanish language speakers who will actively choose not to teach their kids mm-hmm. Spanish, or in order to, one, make sure they don't grow up with an accent, two, not make them a target.
Right. Yep. 100%. We see this three-generational trend in both. This is actually a great comparison in both migrant families and in indigenous language communities. You see this three-generational thing. We've got the first generation that was in some way usually traumatized, or mm-hmm. at the very least, like came to associate their language with very negative things. So in the case of migrant communities, it's like you're trying not to stand out. You want to fit in. In the case of indigenous communities, it was often that an entire generation was forcibly sent to Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding schools mm-hmm. in the United States context. And of course, Canada had similar, and countries all over the world have adopted similar policies on the basis of that kind of Prussian language education model of like getting everyone, schools were kind of seen, sorry, not language education, but just education in general. This model that came out of Prussia was kind of modeled on like the Industrial Revolution, and we want our schools to be like factories and turn out our kids to be these like model citizens. And that's still basically the schooling model that the US operates under. Mm-hmm. And so under that ideology, you had kids like forcibly removed from their families and sent to these boarding schools where they were punished for speaking their language. So they came to quickly associate their language as something that got them in trouble, made them stand out. They shouldn't do it. So naturally, it's not surprising that that generation decided not to teach that language to their kids because they didn't want their kids to go through the same kind of traumatic experience that they did. But then what happens is the next generation, well, I should also say that second generation, the kind of funny thing is that oftentimes they know how to get yelled at in their language. Because if you think about it, you get very animated and activated and emotionally like riled up, you tend to revert to your first language. Uh-huh. And so parents, you know, pretty consistently will like yell at their kids in their first language. And so that's like the one thing they know how to say in the language. And oftentimes they have a lot of passive bilingualism, like they'll understand, but they can't really produce a lot of the language. But then that third generation grows up and they're like, why didn't I ever get a chance to learn my heritage language? Like, I'm resentful of this. And so it's interesting.
For because example, they get to be removed from the trauma. And they don't associate the language with the trauma and the racism and the bigotry. And they're like, oh, I just want the good parts of this.
Right, exactly. And it's good, you know, it's a good thing that we have, you know, that these subsequent generations have like, it's not as much of a concern for them. It's like, oh, I don't care if I stand out a little better. This is great. This is what helps make me unique. It's part of my identity, you know. So it's cool that the story has shifted a little bit over the generations.
It's so funny, the more that we learn about other cultures, the more that we can kind of see ourselves in others and others in ourselves. I what you're telling me also reminds me of how I am seeing some younger folks, some younger queer kids, like in their early 20s and stuff, interact with queerness, interact with identity and presentation and language. And it is so different from how, you know, I did.
Yeah, same.
Stuff that I had to internalize, the words that were used as slurs against me, and the reclamation that had to happen, and the internal unpacking that I've had to do, and the therapy, and all of that. And it's so interesting to see, like, oh, well, you grew up largely without this trauma, so for you, you're seeing the good parts of this, totally, or the power in this.
Yeah,
and it's not that it's not a valid. It's both of us are experiencing very valid emotions and very valid attachments or detachments to it. But it's so interesting how those generational divides, you know, create these like,
not even
power dynamics, but value dynamics, I suppose.
Right. Because I, from the way you talk about it, and I assume kind of similar to mine, is like, you know, the coming out process was not like a happy thing for me.
Nope.
It was scary. It wasn't something
very painful, very terrifying.
Right.
What if people find out? What happens if the bad people find out? What if I'm too obvious in certain places, he says with his limp wrist.
Right. Yeah. Especially growing up in rural Virginia, but like I did, you know, it's so, yeah. And so, yeah, it's interesting now seeing some kids that have never really had to worry about that. And I love it. It's wonderful. It's nice.
I'm so glad. It's so wonderful. It's just so interesting, the parallels of how trauma informs what we choose to pass on, what we choose to embrace, what we choose to value, and then the lack of it tends to create a re-embracing of that.
Actually, we should come back to this later. There's I have a theory too about how, at least for gay men, that's the context in which I have for this, why that connects to gay men liking linguistics so much.
I do have questions for you later about the gay language, which I didn't even know existed until I listened to this poetry podcast.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah, no, I love talking about that. So yeah, going back to the kind of multi-generational thing, we see this interesting situation with the Mohawk community, for example, where you have these elderly speakers who are really just good in the language. And then this middle generation that never really learned it. And now you've got this whole generation of kids that is learning it again that are really good. And they're kind of like this gap in the middle. And it's cool. It's good that it's being revitalized. But I mean, we've even got, was it Assassin's Creed 3? The main character is Mohawk. And like all of his dialogue for a chunk of the video game is in Mohawk, spoken by some of the younger speakers. So it's really cool to see. We also see it not just with indigenous language communities, but like I said, with migrant communities. And there was a study recently that was a really good example of that, among looking at Jewish names. And it looked at like the first generation of Jewish immigrants into the United States, and they were giving their children names that helped them fit into this very Anglo or Irish community. And then that shifted back to being more uniquely Jewish names over the couple of generations. And so nowadays you've got a high, you can actually see like the growth of incidence of more uniquely Jewish names that are given to kids the longer that a family has been in the United States. So they're kind of re-embracing their identity. It's kind of cool.
That is really cool. And again, I also see that in just my husband's a Mexican immigrant. So I see this a lot. I'm very directly connected to that community. And you see that as well in that community where, or they'll have like a name in Spanish. I'm using air quotes here for anybody that can't see a name in Spanish and then a name in English.
Right.
You see this in Asian American communities as well. Yeah, there's a bunch of migrant communities where they'll have a name in their native language, their first language, and an English sounding name so they can fit in better. And that's fascinating, sad, empowering. And it's, you know, as I guess as an outsider, you never quite know how to feel about that because you want to project all these things onto it. But also that takes away autonomy. It's a very paternalistic.
Right. As a linguist, I'm certainly capable of pronouncing, and a linguist with an ear for tone, I'm certainly capable of pronouncing, you know, the Mandarin and Cantonese names of my many East Asian students that I had in Southern California. But even though I could and occasionally did and they'd love it, it would still be like, well, but that's not how you're choosing to present yourself in this context. So I respect that. Like, I will call you Jenny. You know, that's, yeah.
I want to ask a broader question. What's the purpose of language?
Ooh. So a lot of people will say that the purpose is communication, but there's obviously plenty of contexts where that doesn't seem to be the case. Like, we language with ourselves, right? We have this internal dialogue going on. There are enough contexts where we're not really using language to communicate. Sometimes we're using it just purely expressively in things. But it does seem to be that that was kind of like the primary evolutionary function and pressure of language. And that's what shapes language too. Language is the way it is because of what we use language to do. And that is like one of the, I know it sounds kind of straightforward, but that's one of like the biggest kind of realizations that has come out of the cognitive revolution in linguistics in the past like 50 years, is realizing that so much of like down to the specifics of grammar of language are shaped by aspects of like how we're using language. So any of the cases where a language has or doesn't have certain grammatical features or vocabulary that you might expect are because people are using language to do something. So let me give you a specific example. This is one of my favorites. The Navajo language does not have just one verb for any of the actions having to do with position or giving or taking or putting, placing, anything like that. And I said they have 13 different verbs for every one of those actions, depending on the shape and size of the object. So if I were to say that this bookmark is sitting here, it's a flat, thin thing. So you would say siltzos. Whereas if I wanted to say that this worry stone is this kind of roundish thing is sitting here, I would say si'ah because it's round. And if I wanted to say that this pen is sitting here because it's a long, thin stick-like thing, I would say siti. And these aren't. And so the si part is just like a generic like it prefix. And it's the verb at the end that's different. So it's like a total. So it's not just a verb meaning to sit or be sitting there. It's a verb meaning for a flat, thin thing to be sitting there. It's a verb meaning for a roundish thing to be sitting there. Very cool, right?
That's so cool.
And tons and tons of, I could go on and on and on with examples about this. Another really exciting one that people tend to love is absolute directional reckoning versus relative directional reckoning. So some languages, even though they may have words for left and right, they primarily, that's not the default way with which they talk about directions. So I would say that like this cup is sitting to the south of me or to the southeast of me. And I would constantly
would be you kind of, say that, Danny? Would you say the cup is sitting south of me? Hey, could you get me that cup in the southeasterly quadrant of the house?
Well, that's exactly how these languages work, is they like that's the default. So it's actually a really good way to think about it is like gender in English. When you obviously, this is becoming a more complicated issue these days. But for the most part, like when you use a pronoun to talk about something, you are just kind of forced by the English language to make a decision about the grammatical gender of the thing you're talking about. Of course, now that's starting to also be affected by natural gender of the things we're talking about. That's something that's becoming more contentious and whatnot. But yeah, so you'd have to decide, like, am I going to refer to that thing using the grammatical masculine, grammatical feminine, or grammatical neuter gender? Or same in Spanish, right? You know, what?
Oh, yeah, the five love language. I mean, they're called the romance languages because they gender everything.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, yeah, so we're
Mrs.
forced
Fork and Mr. Cup and, well, no,
right, right.
Mrs. Cup, but.
We're forced to do that in the Romance languages, but so many other languages in the world aren't forced to do that. Swahili does also have what you can think of it like genders, but they're really better called noun classes. And they're not based on anything having to do with gender. They're actually just other kind of random categories. So animateness, like are they animate? Are they plants? Are they things that come in pairs? Are they things that are like technology? Are they abstract concepts? Each of those is like a different gender in Swahili. Swahili has 13 different genders. So the prefix you use on a verb or on an adjective has to agree with what category it is. If I want to say person, the prefix is m. So you say mtu, mtu. If I wanted to say thing, the prefix is ki. So you say kitu, kitu. And so you can see how that, it's the root is the same. It's like entity. And the prefix varies. And you could do like, there's other categories too. And so many languages categorize the world in very different ways. You see this in East Asian counting systems, for example. Like you have different sets of numbers depending on the shape and size of the object. And then, so you might count like cups of water differently than you might count people. You have different counting terms for those, like different numbers for one based on what you're counting. And so that's not, you can see how there's kind of this continuum between things like Spanish gender on the one hand and Navajo verb classification on the other, right? All it is like different ways of kind of categorizing the world. And it's a matter of whether those categories are expressed on the verb or on the noun or on the count, on the number, whatever.
The only thing that my brain can come up with as something like as like pre-existing knowledge to project like, oh, well, that's not weird because this other language does that. And you already know that.
You do that. So it's very handy to de-exoticize other languages by comparing it to it. Yeah.
Is Greek is all of the words for love that Greek has.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of people are familiar with that, you know, agape and eros and all of that. Yeah. Especially if you went to Sunday school, you know about agape and eros. You got those deep down in there. But I like that because, you know, take that and like, oh, well, that's not weird because this other thing does that, but they're doing it in this whole other way. That's so cool.
So not only is that in of itself awesome, I think, and it just seems like you agree, but what's really neat about this is it starts to actually give us hints into slightly more fundamental features about how human cognition works. So one of the categories that is very, very consistently distinguished across languages is animacy. And we've discovered that there's this entire thing called the animacy hierarchy that pops up in language after language after language. So back to Navajo. In Navajo, you always have to put the nouns in a clause before the verb. So the verb always comes at the end of the clause. But the order of the nouns is set. So you always put the more animate thing first in the clause and then the less animate thing. So if you wanted to say like the man pet the dog, then you'd say man, dog, pet. And if you wanted to say the dog bit the man, you would still say man, dog, bit. And the nouns would still be in that order. And so the way you distinguish which one is doing the action to which is by there's this little suffix on the verb that you change. It's a ye versus a bit, depending on whether the more animate thing's acting on the less animate thing or vice versa. And so there's this whole hierarchy. It's humans, it's children, animals, like bugs, plants and insects, rocks, other stuff. And at the very top of the hierarchy is lightning. Because humans don't ever act on lightning. Lightning always acts on humans, right? Like how often do you say like he did something to the lightning? You don't do that, right? Yeah. And so what I love about that example is it shows that, like, first off, this isn't some like rigid, strict hierarchy. It's more just about kind of like how often we talk about things, right? But because we tend, like, as humans, we're attentive to what other humans are doing. And we're always focused on, like, you know, what, how we're interacting with the world. We're not as focused on like what other entities in the world are doing. And so that starts to become coded into the language, and that becomes the default. It's only when you have the unexpected situation of like a rock acting on a man that it becomes like you have to mark it with that special prefix on the verb. And we see these kind of like subtle privileging of this, of things higher on the animus hierarchy all over languages. So, and Chitimacha, for example, most nouns don't have plurals. You just use the same noun for singular and plural. It's like Japanese. But the nouns that do have plurals are humans and people and jobs and doctors and stuff like that. In English, the only pronouns that make gender distinctions are for animate people, right? And we've got a few random exceptions, but for the, by default, like you only make that distinction in the animate. So there's all these subtle ways in which this animacy hierarchy pops up like over and over and over across languages. And it really,
I just like to say the one caveat to that is if you happen to be gay, then everything has a gender and almost all of it is cis.
Right, right.
If your car isn't going to start, it's like, girl, I'm going to need you. I'm going to need you to get it together.
This is one of the kind of amazing and complicating things about language is that we can start using these, like once these features are in place, we can start using them to do other stuff. And it gets to the point where that other use starts to become the meaning of the word. Yeah. So, you know, eventually that could.
So I want to start getting into that subject because that's what that is a good deal of the content that you make on social media is kind of parsing out word origins, evolution of language, the uniqueness that regionality plays into all of that. So I want to start that conversation with one. I don't know if you remember in the early days of YouTube, there was a channel called Hot for Words, and I was not just obsessed with Hot for Words. Uh-huh. I bought her book.
I don't think I realized there was one.
Oh my God. Yeah. I bought it at a library sale because I also didn't know there was one. But like she called herself a philologist. Apparently she was a professional philologist or taught it or something, which I thought was very cool. And it was for the reason why this show, when it was named something else, had a word of the day segment where I talked about word origins like for 13 years. I loved it so much.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more. My place in tech changes every day. But I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Yeah, so I was fascinated by the origin of words. Why do you think, because you talk about this subject a lot on social media, why do you think it's important for people to understand where, you know, how language has evolved and where words originate?
The main reason I talk about it so much is because it does a great job disseminating some really unfortunate ideologies that people have about language that oftentimes are kind of rooted in various biases they have. People will use language to justify whatever pre-existing held belief that they have. If you want to believe that, so here's a kind of classic example that happened in the early 1900s. If you want to believe that indigenous people are like not capable of thinking to the same level of abstraction as, you know, Anglo whites, then you go look at a language like Navajo and you say, oh man, this language has so many specific categories. They're not capable of thinking in the abstract. And then that's where that whole myth about words for snow comes from. There are lots of words for snow in Inuit languages. It's actually words for ice is what it is. It's not snow. But we also have tons of words for like rain and precipitation in English. You think about like a drizzle or sleet or, you know, I once sat down and made a list of like 40 of them, right?
Yeah, I always love when people think it's some kind of gotcha on social media. Be like, well, in my language, we would just call that rain. Can't people just say right. rain? And I'm like, okay, well, as a writer, I could call that 50 different things and never use right. the word rain, and you would still understand the picture that I've, and it might be a more specific picture. It might tell you what kind of rain, it might tell you the kind of rain that put you in a certain mood, the kind of rain that right, exactly. nourishes, the kind of rain that floods. Like all of those things are different things, and they all use different language to tell you a similar but not the same story.
Yeah. So but I think that history of words oftentimes like belies those truths and shows like, oh, you know. Okay, so a very good example is talking about man and woman. Also like human, the word human, and just the word man in general. So gender around the word man. So the word man used to not be gendered. The word man was the word for person. Mm-hmm. And it was only later that it started to be used specifically to talk about men. So this is why we still have a lot of older expressions like mankind mm-hmm. and the man and human is the generic use of man. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of this weird accident of history that it's become gendered over time. But now people who don't know that history just see like, why is it that man is the default? Why isn't woman the default? Well, it's because it actually was the default before it meant man, right? So the direction is the other way around. So people make a lot of assumptions about, like, they think that situation today is a reflection of, you know, a patriarchal system in the past. And while it's true that that patriarchal system has been there, obviously, the language is not evidence of that. It's that people have like used that as like, I'm going to take this as evidence for it, even though history doesn't justify that. Same with gender. So when linguists used the term gender to talk about masculine and feminine gender in Indo-European languages, the word gender didn't yet have anything to do with like sexual presentation. It doesn't mean gender in the sense that we mean it today. That is a modern sense of the word gender. Gender is related to the word genre. It just meant like a type or a kind. Right. So what linguists were doing back in like the 1800s, yeah, is they were like, oh, these are the different genders, different kind of realizations of this thing. It was only later, after that use of gender, that people started using it to refer specifically to what, you know, kind of the sex related gender, even though.
It's I want to go back to that.
Right.
Like what kind of genre of person are you? Oh, I love that.
Yeah. That is so good. Yeah.
Oh, I'm here for that.
Yeah. So like it used to be that these categories it was acknowledged, of course, that in Indo-European, like, the word man falls into one category and the word woman falls into another category. And that's where the kind of sex-related gender notion came out of. But for the most part, they're just thought of as like categories. And that's why linguists today, because the term gender has had all of these much more modern associations attached to it, and the meaning of the word gender has now changed. Now linguists are switching again and saying noun classes instead of gender, because noun classes is a more neutral description of like they're just different categories of nouns. It doesn't have anything to do with like actual physical gender or anything like that.
I want to talk about descriptivism versus prescriptivism.
You're making this my favorite interview I've done so far. This is great. Your questions are wonderful.
Thank you so much. So kind of you. What are those? Let's define our terms for the audience. What is descriptivism? What is prescriptivism? When is either appropriate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when are they not? And why is social media so fucking hell-bent on prescriptivism?
Those are all wonderful questions.
Thank you.
Actually, each of those are great. I'll try and answer them each in turn. So, as a linguist, we're scientists. And so we're interested in the way that language actually works. We're not interested in the way people think language ought to work.
Oh, I like that.
Right. So And the fact is language changes. I know this distresses people, but language changes. It's very natural. It's also very natural for language to have lots of variation. It's absolutely insane to think that everybody is going to speak the same way. That's just like, given the diversity and the distance and the time between different people, you're going to have variation introduced. Like, even if everyone this instant started speaking one language all exactly the same, within a week, there would be variation and you'd start seeing different languages like fracture off. And this is how new languages are made. You start with just like little dialectical variations, and eventually they become more and more and more until you have two totally distinct languages. So what used to be Latin has now fractured into Spanish and French and Romanian and so on. So that's the difference between prescriptivism, is saying, here's how we think language ought to be, versus descriptivism, which is a scientific approach to language. It's, here's how language is, here's how language operates. So a lot of people think, they come across like words that they call slang, and they're like, oh, that's just, you know, it's not grammatical, it's not a real thing. So when people started saying gonna, for example, everyone was like, oh, that's just slang. They're just like, you know, shortening their words and writing it and whatnot. But it turns out there are rules to when you can say gonna and when you can't. Mm-hmm. So you can say like, you know, I'm gonna eat later, but you can't say I'm gonna the store.
That's true.
Right. And so if you were to go through a corpus of English and you'd look at all the instances of gonna, what you would find is that it's only used when it's got a future intended action interpretation. And basically gonna is now a modal verb, just like will and could and would. Right.
I love and language.
So right. And so it started from, this is a great example of what we call grammaticalization in language, where a word that started having a kind of very concrete like lexical meaning, like talking about like an action or a thing, like going, right, starts to have a grammatical meaning instead. And so now going has become gonna, and now it's like a future tense marker instead of whatever. So it's actually very similar to Spanish. You know, it used to be most speakers of Spanish would say like, you know, I will eat, comeré, right? But now they say voy a comer. And so that voy a is becoming the future tense. Mm. So you have these changes like that. And so that originally was like, people would think about that as slang, but it's actually this rule governed, well-structured thing. And so if you took the prescriptivist approach and you just said like, oh, that's slang, that's not how you ought to be speaking, you would miss what happened if you did like an objective analysis of it as a linguist, as a grammarian, and figured out what's actually happening. You would just miss that rule. You would miss that just like this new grammatical rule has come into place.
Well, it also says that language stopped at some point. Prescriptivist says language stopped when you took, I don't know, English in sophomore year. Language stopped then, and there has been no growth, and there can't be growth, and it only is whatever you learned in 10th grade English, and it can't be what somebody else learned in 10th grade English on another part of the country or around the world or whatever, you know, and it allows for no variation or misunderstanding or growth of any kind.
And that gets to the heart of, I think, kind of your last question, is why are people so pressed about this? And it's because they, again, like they will use language to like justify whatever it is they, whatever, you know, ideas they already have. And also because language is a marker of identity and social class and educational upbringing and things, right? So you have people that, you know, see, like if you encounter a slang word that's come from a minority community, you're probably going to, well, not you, but one might be more, be far less receptive.
I'm not perfect because there's, listen, who I was 20 years ago would probably have been like, well, no, that's not the way. So I have some bad takes, I'm sure.
But yeah, I mean, so a really good example of this, I mean, so many things that come out of African American vernacular English get just like absolutely disparaged up front. And then it's only when people don't realize that it's come from African American vernacular English that people love it. So all
like
of Gen Z,
giving mother, pretty much everything Gen Z says.
Yeah. Everything, all
every
Gen Z
single
slang.
Thing Gen Z says comes from Black queer people in the 80s and 90s. And I'm like, exactly. Baby, we need to give them their due.
So And it is cool to see that it's like now becoming more mainstream like that. But I would like to see also more appreciation of that history, which is why I talk about these histories more.
Yes.
But a great example of this is, so in English, we have that ing ending. And that G used to be pronounced. You used to say things like running. And then over time.
And if you're a theater kid, you still do.
Right. So, and this is really important to distinguish between like spelling and pronunciation here. Keep that in mind. So that G used to be pronounced. And that G would have an effect on the N before it. It used to be like an N followed by a G, but that N started to be pronounced like an engma instead. So like the sound at the end of sing. English used to actually not have that ng sound at the end of sing, not as its own sound. It wasn't until these Gs started dropping out, and then all that was left is what is the effect of that G on the previous N. And so it used to be singa, and it became singa, and then sing. And so until those Gs started dropping out, English didn't have that engma sound. It didn't have ng. And that's why to this day, you can only use that engma at the ends of syllables, not the beginning, because you never had a word that started with ng. So you can't say like other like Swahili, the word for cow is ngombe. It starts with a nga, but we can't do that in English. So that's what happened over time. But people then in African American English, people started pronouncing that engma just as an N. And so instead of saying like running, they would say runnin. Very common, like you recognize that immediately as like a very salient feature of African American English. And so what happened there was one sound changed into another sound, an engma changed into an N. Now, what didn't happen is a sound wasn't lost. It wasn't as though African American speakers suddenly stopped pronouncing a sound at the end of the word. That sound just changed. Very, very natural sound change. Sounds change in languages all the time. An engma to an N, super common. You see it in languages all over the world. But the way people reacted to that is they were like, oh, these black people keep dropping sounds off the ends of words because they're lazy, which is not what happened at all. No sound was dropped off the end of the word, right? It just was an engma changing into an N. And it was the spelling that kind of convinced people like to think about it that way. But the spelling like had nothing to do with it. And so this is such a good example of how people's pre-existing, you know, attitudes towards a community affect how they interpret something about language. And so if we go into language with a prescriptive lens about how something ought to be, we miss this fact. We lose the objectivity of understanding what's actually going on here. And we see that kind of thing time and time again.
So as a writer, I do tell other writers that there is a place for prescriptivism. It's usually in the written word, or if you are giving some kind of formal speech. And I think the advocacy for prescriptivism there is that it creates a more unified written text that can be more widely understood by people. But even then, I don't want people to think that prescriptivism wins out 100% and you must
write your paper. Otherwise, where would their written creativity be, right?
Like, right. There's a meeting ground between where we are still able to describe, you know, we are still able to use language as it is being used, but the prescriptivism comes in and says, okay, but there are still rules to how this is used. So let's make sure that there is consistency throughout and clarity. So could this phrase be misunderstood? I just had that in an edit for the book I have coming out, or one of the books I have coming out. Okay. You know, they're like, well, yes, this word means this. But once that hits social media, you're going to get made fun of. And I was like, okay. The word was fetish. I don't know why I'm being cagey about it. And it was specifically used in magical context.
That's kind of one of the more traditional canonical uses of the word. But now it's become so overridden by modern uses. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they were like, my editor was like, we can keep this. But the way that this sentence is structured is not going to read well. So maybe let's choose a different word, because is that something you want on social media? So,
and you're like, yes, that's exactly something I want on social media.
So I do think that there is a place. I don't want to I don't want people to come away from this and think like prescriptivism equals bad.
Right,
I think
right.
there's a place for it. I just think that it needs to be understood. Would you agree with that?
I actually think I might disagree a little bit okay. for a couple of reasons. Yeah. So there is a sense in which, like, if we just throw out all the rules, how could we even language, right? Doesn't,
right.
you know? So it's like, if I just wanted to start suddenly using a different past tense and say like, you know, like ish instead of ed, like I, you know, I ate ish or something like that, you wouldn't know what the heck I was talking about if I just started using other words. So there is a pressure to adhere to existing conventions. And I think it is very useful to think about it in terms of conventions and conventionality. It is no different than any other social convention. Like in the US context, I can do a handshake. And I think we can agree that you can do a handshake wrong. Like there are ways to do it wrong, but there's within handshakes, there's like a huge variety of handshakes, right? And it's
remember
a social
the Boy Scout handshake was supposed to be this thing. This was supposed to be the Boy Scout handshake.
Yeah.
Yep. I think I've done that once in my life and it felt so wrong. I was like, no, thank you.
And in some communities, like the Navajo, for example, are very big on not imposing themselves on others. And so if they do a handshake at all, it'll be very, very light. They'll just grab your hand, just kind of like hang on to it for a second. And that's very normal. And so some people would consider that like that's not a handshake because that's not this traditional like American prototype of like the strong, firm handshake or whatnot. And so language is kind of similar. Like I can, for example, pronounce think as fink if I'm a certain dialect of British, and you'll still understand what I mean. You may not even pay attention to the fact that, oh, I just said an F instead of a TH.
Yes, Adele.
right. So
thank you very much.
You know, and we tolerate so much variation in language without even realizing it. Mm-hmm. It's when we realize it's only when we start to have issues with certain variation that we start to pay attention to it. It's only when we attach certain variations with certain social categories that we have distaste towards that we start to get irritated by it. There's nothing objectively better or worse about saying an N versus an Angma. It has everything to do with the attitudes you attach towards the people that speak that way.
Okay, fine.
Oh, but so, okay. But as for the writing.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you were, okay. So the thing is writing is different from language. And this is one of the first things I have to kind of get into my, I have to get into my undergrads' heads about this. Writing is simply a way of representing language, and writing is not a natural thing. You don't like every human being that doesn't have some sort of like abnormal development or kind of interceding situation is going to develop language, right? Like that's just a core feature of what it is to be human, is you will eventually language. That's not the case with writing. For the majority of history, most people have never learned literacy, right? So writing is this skill that you have to acquire. It is this social set of conventions that you have to acquire in education. And when people criticize other people's writing, really what they're doing is they're criticizing them for their education. So if you haven't had the same level of access to educational opportunities, if you haven't had the same kind of support for those educational opportunities, right? Like if it's like a difficult study situation at home, you're maybe not going to be aware of some of the subtleties of, you know, using adverbs and gerunds and split infinitives and stuff like that, that are part of like what it means to be a good writer. Like to do these things well is like this whole suite of skills that you learn that signals like, hey, I know these conventions. I know how to use them and master them and like play with them. And it's like the fact that you know how to play with these conventions signals your awareness of them, right? Mm-hmm. But it really does just kind of come down to like an educational difference in educational opportunities. But it is important to remember that writing is this just separate thing from language. It's just this thing that is kind of
weirdly used. I never thought about it that way. But I don't know. I mean, I get we could probably spend a million years because then that makes me wonder about things that are not, I mean, you know, things that are not verbal language, things that are not, I mean, like sign language, emojis, hieroglyphics. I mean, you know, like we are languaging
right.
in stuff that isn't audible speech. And we've done that for a long time.
So I would say, okay, so it's important to make a distinction between language and gesture. So sign language, full language, 100%, fully robust grammatical system, every bit as well-structured and rule-governed as English or any other language. They're just the conventions of how things are expressed are different. Emojis, not a language. Emojis are much more similar to...
First of all, how dare you say something so bold and so wrong here on this, the most sacred of platforms, a podcast.
Maybe, yeah, I suppose emojis are kind of similar to like subtle, like, you know, Japanese fan expressions from, you know, using fans to signal things. Right?
Are emojis not the modern hieroglyphics? Is that not, I mean, there's a system to emojis. There's meaning. Well,
there's a greater system to hieroglyphics. Hieroglyphics were like, you know, you had a set of inputs and you could get an output of like what was intended. Emojis, you can't. Emojis are much more similar to gestures than they are to language. You should think of emojis like digital gestures.
Sure. I mean, and they can certainly help like express the tonality of yep. something written. Yep. But I also, I guess I also liken it a little bit to sign language, like you said, where somebody's facial expression, where you know, so much of sign language is also the physicality of it, the way that the sign is embodied.
Sign language is actually part of the grammar.
Right.
So if you don't have, you're probably aware of this, but for those who aren't, like, think about in spoken language, we have pitch to help indicate intonation, right? But in sign languages, if you're deaf, you don't have pitch to help. So pitch is kind of this like extra layer of information that's added onto the physical words you're saying, right? So what's the equivalent of that in sign language? Facial expressions. And so if I want to ask a question in American Sign Language, I do it with raised eyebrows. And it's like, if you don't do that, it is ungrammatical. You are not asking a question. So facial expressions are part of the grammar of American Sign or any sign language. And kind of similarly, like in English, you know, the difference between like a statement and a question is just intonation. So these intonational patterns are part of the grammar of English. Whereas no one's going to say you've made a sentence ungrammatical by, you know, having a smiley face at the end of it or not. But it does, of course, affect the tone of the message. And you're absolutely right. And that's why
all of this that we're talking about is one of the reasons why, like, people who are autistic talk about the difficulty in communication, because all of this is kind of unspoken rules that we all know, but we don't know why we know.
Right.
And those are things that get missed whenever you are somebody that takes things kind of at face value, more literally.
Yep. And emojis, like, have their kind of literal sort of, you know, you can
interpret. Listen, it they can like say whatever thing. They want. Yeah. That emoji doesn't mean that. It means whatever we mean.
Yeah, like the skull emoji has nothing, you know, like in modern context, it means like I'm laughing so hard I'm dying.
Yeah,
right? And that in itself is being used hyperbolically.
Yeah.
So
I want to talk about, because there's certainly difference in language, but I want to talk about the role that regionality and accent play in language. So I was born in West Virginia. So yay.
Oh, okay. Right over the mountains from me.
Yeah. I was born in West Virginia down south, Huntington. But I was raised in Texas and now I live here in the Midwest. So, you know, I understand that like, the way, like, we had a town name in West Virginia called Hurricane. It's spelled Hurricane. And if you pronounce it Hurricane, we are all going to know you're not from here.
Right. Yeah.
You know, et cetera, et cetera. And these kinds of things happen. Like the Midwestern ope. Like ope.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I learned that. There's a whole grammatical structure to ope, you know, and when y'all reused and the tonality of bless your heart.
Canadian A and yeah.
Sure. So I'd like you to speak a little bit about kind of the role that accent or regionality within a language plays in our own understanding, and also the role it plays in the evolution of language.
Nice. Oh, great. Great question. So the dialects and accents are basically that variation I was talking about earlier. And a lot of people simply just don't have a lot of exposure to language communities outside of their own, at least until later, until you might move to an urban center or something. And even then, people living in an urban center often just like, it's amazing how sheltered someone can be living in like a huge metropolitan area like New York or LA or something like that, and still have not gotten a lot of exposure to other ways of speaking. And so then what happens is when you encounter some other way of speaking, you're like, oh, that's wrong. So there's a, I'll be able to find it in 2 seconds. There's a great little study that was done where they gave a bunch of undergrads maps of the United States. And they said, hey, draw all the dialect areas of the United States and label them. Oh, God. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't have to be
thousands.
Like, sometimes, yeah. Some of them were like super detailed. Others were pretty straightforward or whatnot. So what I'm going to show you here is one of those maps from, and I'll dictate this verbally for anyone who doesn't have the visual. So it's a map of the United States, and it's got certain areas circled and labeled for what the dialects are. So here, and, you know, I'll just like report this as is, because part of this exercise is to show kind of the biases that people have mm-hmm. when they approach language. So this map, here's a, you can see the map. Uh-huh. That's what it looks like.
Yeah.
And Alaska's circled and it says Eskimos. Interesting. Whoa. You know, that's right. But that's like the association people have. California circled and it said Sunnyside.
Okay.
Texas is circled and it says Hillbillies.
That's not, no, that's not where the hillbilly, that's not.
Right.
Sorry. I'm going to let you keep talking.
Southeast is wrong. Southerners. Southeast is Southerners. Okay. Northeast says British. And then there's one state, Wisconsin, that's circled. It says average or normal. You want to guess where this student was from?
Wisconsin.
Right. And that's what happens. Every one of these students will have some area that is labeled like normal, average, standard American English. And of course, it winds up being the area where they're from.
Uh-huh.
And there is still a little bit of variation where there is some bias where some people, even in their own area, will say that I speak bad English. So there is a little bit of bias. And when you actually go state by state, it turns out some states are just kind of more objectively judged as having like worse grammar. So,
anyone with a Southern accent? Like, wasn't there a whole study on that?
Yeah. And that really reveals some very deep-seated biases in American culture against Southern culture, understandably, given the historical
wasn't
context.
Weren't there other studies that said that Southerners speak more correct English is the wrong phrase there, but English right. that's like closer to the, what was it? The Queen's English or something like
yeah,
that because of migration patterns and where people came from, like Southern is closer to how we used to speak English.
Yeah. Certain features of Southern English are more conservative in the kind of standard sense of conservative, not the political sense of conservative, than other like Northern features, but also like New England English. The reason New England English is so distinctive is in part because it's retained some of the features that were brought over from British. So mm-hmm. Some people distinguish the words C-O-T and C-A-U-G-H-T, caught and caught. For most American speakers, they're just one vowel that you use for both of them. But in the Northeast, they have that vowel distinction. And that's a distinction that's retained from British English.
I feel like in the South, if anybody is using a single syllable for anything, they're mad at you. Like you
right, get, exactly.
Get.
Yeah.
Well, see, that was even two. That was two.
Get. Yeah, no, it was. It's called vowel breaking when you have vowels kind of come apart like that. Yeah. So this... So what happens is people like encounter these other ways of speaking for the first time and they're like, this is wrong, not realizing that, oh, okay, I'm just privileging my own perspective there. In terms of attitudes, that's kind of what's happening. And then in terms of evolution of language, this is how languages change. You know, this is like, it could be a thousand years from now, you know, Southern English is its own language.
Oh, a thousand years from now, whatever we're currently speaking now will be so dead and gone. It's, you know,
yeah.
And if you don't think that's true, just go, you know, like go read Old English is where the language came from. We can't even read it.
Yeah. The Lord's Prayer in Old English started, Father, you are through the out and helfenum, gehalgehod through the nama. Right. Like,
okay. So now I get to ask the stupid question that most people ask you up front. How many languages do
you okay. So imagine if you will.
No.
Reading a textbook of Spanish and you didn't know a lick of Spanish and you read the book from cover to cover.
Sure.
At the end of reading that textbook, you would know a lot of things about the grammar of Spanish.
Okay.
But could you speak it?
No.
Right. That's me with like 80 languages.
Christ.
But like, because I've, I mean, like,
Daniel, you're asking about
the outputs, for example.
Why aren't you working for the UN?
This is a grammar, for example, of the Creek language, Muscogee or Creek.
Uh-huh.
It's a language spoken in the Southeast. And, you know, I've read this book cover to cover.
That's very pretty.
It is. Yeah. A good friend of mine, Jack Martin, wrote it. And I've read this book cover to cover, and it's got, you know, verb tables and conjugations and all this stuff. Could I speak Creek? Absolutely not. But can I tell you lots of things about how Creek works and whether it, you know, follows similar patterns to other languages and things? Yes, because that's what I focus on research-wise.
Okay. You know, how many languages could you have a conversation with a native speaker in?
Five, maybe.
Okay, well, that's... That doesn't make me feel bad. I feel like that's like the average European child.
Right, exactly. Yeah. No, so my best second language is Swahili, because for a while...
That's amazing.
Well, for a while, I actually lived in Kenya for a year in undergrad, and then I continued to do research there during grad school, but then I realized I wanted to focus on North American indigenous languages instead. So that's what I do now. So I haven't been back to Kenya for a while, but it's still like my best second language. I got really good at it. My Spanish is fine. I have like some, you know, like low conversational level in French. I can read Latin really well because I have to. Sure.
Yeah, that's useful these days.
Right. Well, but what's funny though is for me, it actually is. Because a lot of the early documentation of Native American languages was written in medieval Latin.
Wow.
They would write. So if you want to go learn about like the Aztec Nahuatl language, it's one of the most comprehensive grammars of a language that was ever written up until like the 1800s. It was all written in Latin. It was like translations of Catholic catechisms into this language. So you have to be able to read Latin to understand this. So... Oh, and you know, going all the way back to your first question, you're asking about this process of like language revitalization, basically, and like mm-hmm. who cares? And what if you
I
just
don't think I asked it quite that way?
No, but it's that's a very reasonable question to ask in the context. It's like, why should someone care about this? Uh-huh. And what about cases of like just throw it in an archive and like maybe someday someone will care about it? That's exactly what happened to the Chitimacha. This language was and so many other indigenous languages. In the case of Chitimacha, the language was documented starting in 1802 up until about 1934 by four different people, and they all just wrote down vocab lists and stuff. And then from 1930 to 1934, this one linguist in particular worked very intently for those 4 years with the last two speakers of the language. And he made a draft dictionary, a draft grammar, and like he wrote down 120 stories in the language. And we even have wax cylinder recordings of some of those early stories. We've got like an hour's worth of recordings, which is stunning. And he deposited those in an archive and then left the country because he was a communist and he got blacklisted in the McCarthy era. So he went down to Mexico. And so those materials sat in that archive in the American Philosophical Society Library in Philadelphia for 70 years. And the tribe never knew about him. Like people kind of knew like, yeah, there was this linguist that came through in the past. And there's like some awareness that this work had been done. And like, you know, why would anyone think like to go like be looking in these archives? Sure. Like you just wouldn't expect it. Right. So then the Library of Congress is where those wax cylinders were stored. And so they had this reclamation project where they were trying to help indigenous communities like reclaim artifacts and things in their collections. And so the tribal council for the Chitimacha got a call one day and they're like, hey, we have wax cylinder recordings in your language. Would you like them? And they were like, what? Okay, what? And so they got to hear recordings of this language for the first time in 70 years, thinking they would never, ever hear a word of this language again.
You know what's the scariest part of October? Being vulnerable to cyber criminals. That's why this Cyber Scaries Month, you need Webroot Total Protection. With all-in-one protection for your devices, privacy, and identity, Webroot Total Protection helps defend every part of your digital life. Change your October from cyber scary to cyber secure with 60% off Webroot Total Protection at www.webroot.com/audio. That's 60% off for a limited time, but only when you go to www.webroot.com/audio.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
And so that sparked them to be like, well, what else is out there? And they went and scoured the archives. And it turns out that there's hundreds of pages of documentation of this language, because this linguist, purely for academic reasons, he just wanted to go publish some papers, went and like documented this language like really in depth, and just kind of sat there until it was ready to be used. And so this is called a lot of times salvage linguistics, where linguists will go in and just kind of document these languages because nobody's like at the point where they're ready to care about it. This happens a lot in African contexts. Like if you are, a lot of communities in Africa just have bigger concerns than trying to save their language. So I've actually worked with a language community called Gusii. It is a language spoken in southwestern Kenya. And it was just mostly two people that got really excited about trying to document and revitalize their language. It's still got several hundred thousand speakers, but all the speakers are like 30, 40 and older, because Kenya has been educating their kids in English and Swahili since
the language is dying out.
Right. So they went to and put together this dictionary of 14,000 words. It's huge. It's ginormous. And are doing a great job with it, but they're very exceptional. Like there's just few, and you know, he's having having to do this while still having full-time jobs and things like, and it's hard to get the entire Gusii community to like try and revitalize this language when they've just got bigger problems on their hands. You know, they're trying to like just make a living selling the tea leaves that they're farming and stuff. So yeah, some of the work that we've done with Gusii, you know, you just kind of have to acknowledge that this might just sit in an archive for 70 years like the Chimacha did. And maybe, you know, one day, you know, a generation from now, when people have the resources and are, you know, affluent enough that they can afford to make this like an interest thing of theirs, then they can come to it. And so that's why archiving in linguistics is really important. You got to make sure it's done well. That it's with a proper archive, that it adheres to all these standards, so it's accessible to someone 100 years from now.
I want to ask you a couple of quick fun questions mm-hmm. as we wrap up here. Infixes in English.
Ooh.
Is there more than one?
English only really has one infix.
And what is it, Dr. Danny Heber, with your PhD? What is the one infix in the English language?
We have expletive infixing, so you could throw a curse word into anything. You could say abso-fucking-lutely, you know, grand fucking fantastic. That one, so, and there's rules to it. You can't just do it randomly. Like, the fact that I just messed it up is a good example of that. It always goes right before the stressed syllable of the word, with a few exceptions that are also rule-governed. Yeah.
So no others? Not any?
None that I'm aware of, no. But in other languages, so like in Tagalog, for example, the future tense marker is an infix. And so you have to add, I believe it's an AM after the first syllable of the word. You just stick it right in the middle of the word and just like it breaks the word in two and you just stick it right in the middle. And that's the present versus future tense.
So invented languages. You see, I've seen this used in two contexts. One, I know that the gays, we made our own language. I didn't even know about that one until very Polari, recently. Right. The first time I heard about people inventing language was in like sci-fi contexts, like Lord of the Rings, like the elves all have like speak Elvish and the language was invented for the movies. Likewise, Star Trek, I think, like Klingon.
Yeah, Klingon, a famous example. Yeah.
Yeah. That you can go to school and you can study Klingon. Invented languages. One, what do we do with them? Two, if you had to invent a language, how do you do that? How do you decide how to invent a language for a fantasy elves?
Well, so a lot of the people who are big into this is called conlangings, constructed languages. So a lot of conlangers who are big into the conlang community really go out of their way to learn a lot about linguistics, to make the languages that they invent as realistic as possible. And I think that's very cool. The Not V language, which was invented for the Avatar movie, the old Avatar movie, not the new stuff. Yeah. The blue aliens. The linguist who invented that, I believe David Peterson, if I'm remembering correctly, really tried to incorporate as many kind of interesting and like sort of exotic or at least complicated grammatical features from the world's languages as he could. So the language like doesn't distinguish between subjects and objects. It's got this other more complicated feature called like ergativity or stuff that I would have to sit down and explain to you for 20 minutes.
No thanks.
And like, because it's so complicated, right? Like he picked these really, and he included sounds that are difficult to make. So it's got what are called ejective stops. So the difference between like a K sound, a ka versus a ka, and a ta versus a ta or a pa. Right. And so you'll hear that in the movie, and the actors had to like learn how to say that. So he was really just having fun with it. He's like, let me find this diverse range of stuff and throw it all in there. Other languages are invented that are meant to be like very expressive of the kind of culture that they're sort of representing. So the Dune movie that came out, for example, mm-hmm. the people living on Dune, I forget their name, the Fremen. They're obviously modeled after Arab tribes, like nomadic groups in the real world. Right. And so some of the names he uses like have that flavor, but they hired a conlanger to create the official language for the movie. And he was really torn by this because he had to try and make decisions about like, well, you know, this is a community that exists on Earth and does not exist in these movies. And like how kind of, genuine do I want to make this? So he wound up like incorporating elements of it, but like having to also try to distance. Yeah. It's interesting.
I don't know. Some of that constructed language stuff can get, especially when the culture is based on real people and the politics around those real people, especially right now.
I got some flack online for saying this, and I did a whole video about it, but I'm not a huge fan of conlanging myself. I have ideas for like, oh, what would I do if I did a conlang or something like that? But I think a lot of the times, like conlangers are love language and they're super fascinated by it. And I think that's great. And it really has done a great job to like bring more visibility to linguistics and language learning and stuff. But I find that most of the time, people that are interested in conlangs, when they start finding about just how like incredibly diverse actual languages are, they're like, holy shit, this is way better.
why not just use a real language that might need some more people to care about it?
Right, exactly. And of course that gets complicated too. Like you don't want the situation where you've got random people coming in like and sort of, you know, co-opting your language for like media uses and whatnot. But what I would love to see more of is partnerships between indigenous communities that do want to kind of give more visibility and audibility, I guess, to their language.
We just see that with a re-record of the Avengers movie? Didn't the entire Avengers cast come back and they, I don't know the name of the language.
No, yeah, I don't know.
They worked for like 6 months with indigenous speakers to completely redub the original Avengers movie like in this language. Yeah, I'll send you the article.
I know they've done that with Navajo. Like maybe. Navajo got dubbed, or sorry, it's Star Wars: A New Hope got dubbed in Navajo, and I actually was fortunate enough to be there for the world premiere of that, and it was so freaking cool to see Darth Vader come out speaking Navajo, being a total badass. And they're now doing Empire Strikes Back too.
Lakota. It was in Lakota.
Oh, yeah. And then there was a movie, Prey. It was like one of the movies in the Predator series. And then I forget which language it was. It was one of the Siouan languages, I think. But like they made a point of hiring indigenous actors who spoke the language and stuff. So I'm really happy to see that. And like I mentioned, like Mohawk and Assassin's Creed, there's more visibility for these indigenous languages. And I would love to keep seeing that. Like even if... I think it'd be really cool if a movie just decided like, okay, you know, here's some random alien species off on this other planet. But like, what if we just asked if like the Lakota people wanted their language used for that? And then that would be a cool, like sort of fact of, you know, piece of trivia about the movie and you could go learn about it. Like seeing that kind of increased visibility would be neat.
Or Pig Latin, either one. A couple of final questions. Is there a feature or a phrase or a type of thing that doesn't exist in the English language that you would love to put into the English language?
I would like evidentiality. So some languages code the source of knowledge for every statement. So Turkish, for example, you have verbs either have to indicate whether it's you have that piece of information as like a direct source of knowledge or an indirect source of knowledge. Is it hearsay? Is it like I heard someone say it? Or did I experience that myself? Right. And some languages get really subtle about that. They have like, is it likely that it's the case? Did I infer that this is the case? Did I hear it?
We need that so desperately, Beth. Right.
Yeah. How cool would that be? Right. And of course, like you could, and some of these languages, when you ask a question, you can say like, is so-and-so hungry? You ask the question using the evidentiality marker that you think is most likely to apply in that situation. So when you say like, is so-and-so hungry? You don't use the direct knowledge suffix, right? Because how would they have direct knowledge of someone else being hungry? You use like the inferred knowledge suffix. But in other cases, it's like, oh, did you see the fireworks? And you use the direct knowledge suffix. So really you have to be really attentive to other people's like knowledge states. Yeah. Another one I think would be really useful is inclusive versus exclusive, we and you. So so if my friend Jack and I, right, are going to the movies later and I say Jack and I inclusive or Jack and I exclusive are going to the movies later, that means us and not you. Versus if I say Jack and I inclusive are going, or like we inclusive are going to the movies later. Do you want to come? You know, so it's like whether the person I'm talking to is included or excluded from the we or from the you.
Oh, see, I just, well, we are going.
Right.
Not we are going.
Yeah, exactly. Like it allows you to be kind of like mean girls about it. And like,
I like that. I appreciate that. Yeah, just without the hand gestures.
Yep.
Do you have a favorite word?
Ooh. I'm a big fan of using the word antediluvian.
Oh, well, that's fun. It's pretty. Yeah, but
I really like using that one, though, because it's so hilariously ironic sometimes. So antediluvian etymologically means before the flood.
Mm-hmm.
Like deluge is a related word. And so I love using it for like modern technology when someone's like, oh yeah, I had to send him a voicemail. And I was like, oh, how antediluvian. It was like voicemails clearly were around long after, you know, the biblical flooding. So that one, and then there's not specific words in other languages that I really, really love, but I think I just love so many of the beautiful like features of other languages. Like one of the languages of the Pacific Northwest called Nunchaknuth, has suffixes for things. So, and like nouns can be verbs. It's crazy. So like, if I want to say like there were two men, I would have use a verb that, and the root of the verb is man. And then it has a suffix meaning two and then like a tense marker. So it's like two men there were, and that's the verb to be two men.
Is that the same as how we verb nouns in English?
Yeah. Except they do it for
a bit in the reverse. Oh, okay. Yeah,
everything. So, you know, like, you know, two boats, they two boated or it two boated. And it would be like, that means there's two boats. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. Danny Huber, I appreciate the time that you have given to me. I am fascinated. I'm probably going to go back and listen to this seven times.
Thank you so much for having me and for the really great questions. I really appreciate it. These are like good questions that I don't get opportunity to talk too much about on podcasts. So thank you for that.
Thank you. But if people want to take the opportunity to go learn more about you and your very vital work that you are doing, how can they find you on social media?
I'm very easy to find on any platform. I'm Linguistic Discovery. You search for that, you'll find me. It's that handle on any platform, except on Twitter/X, it's Ling Discovery. But otherwise you'll find, and there's, you can go to linguisticdiscovery.com too, and that has all the links to things.
And you'll probably find him on social media if there is some kind of video that has gone viral where somebody is trying to correct somebody on their grammar or their word usage or something. You're probably going to see a stitch. from Danny.
Yeah, I don't stand for that. Yeah. I'm like, well, now hang on. We're stepping in. We're going to fix this.
Well, thank you so much for being here, sir.
Yeah, thank you, Don.
And that is going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My thanks to my guest, Danny Heber. Make sure to go give him a follow. His content is really, really good, and I feel smarter every time he comes up in my feed. Now, if you liked this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Consider sharing it with your friends on social media. Literally, that word of mouth is the easiest and best way to organically grow this audience. And if you like it, your friends probably will too. Another way to share with friends you know and friends you don't know, is to like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever app you happen to be listening to this episode on right now. And while you're there, leave a review. Reviews tell the algorithm that this is a buzz with conversation, that people are talking about this show. So, you know, leave a review. A few emojis, literally anything. I did see that we are at 299 reviews on Apple Podcasts, and I would really like someone to take us to a crisp 300. If you would like to do a little bit more, you could join my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, archived episodes, ad-free stuff, and little goodies along the way. Recently, patrons got an article detailing some of the behind-the-scenes stuff about my new novel, Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire. They are also going to be the first people to get any surprise updates, cover reveals, literally anything. If it's about Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire, patrons are going to know about it first. So you can get that at patreon.com/headonfirepod. You can also follow me at headonfirepod all over social media. Now I'm going to go, but remember, never stop seeking illumination like a man with his head on fire seeks water. Be well.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.